Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Colson Whitehead grew up in Manhattan, a kid who liked to read, collect comics, and watch television, and who imagined he might someday make a living by writing about werewolves. After graduation from Harvard, he worked at the Village Voice, where he wrote reviews of television, books, and music. His first novel, The Intuitionist, concerned intrigue in the Department of Elevator Inspectors, a book critic Walter Kern called the freshest racial allegory since Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man and Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. The San Francisco Chronicle wrote that Whitehead shares Joseph Heller's sense of the absurd, Pynchon's operatic expansiveness, and Morrison's deconstruction of race and racism. His second novel, John Henry Days, a finalist for the Pulitzer, combined the story of the legendary steel-driving man with that of a bunch of freeloading journalists. And his third novel, Apex Hides the Hurt, is about an African-American nomenclature expert who is hired to rename a town. I once knew someone who, a poet, who actually had a job naming companies. It's an interesting kind of job. The company was called Name Freaks. His new novel, Sag Harbor, is a first-person coming-of-age novel set in the town where Whitehead's family summered since the 1940s. Come on in and make yourself welcome. His reviews, essays, and fiction have appeared in such publications as The New York Times, The New Yorker, New York Magazine, Harper's, and Granta, and he is a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, a Whiting Writers Award, and a fellowship at the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. We're very pleased to have in conversation with Colson tonight Adam Bradley, who is a scholar of African-American literature, a critic of Black popular culture, and an associate professor of literature at Claremont McKenna College. Adam is the co-editor of the forthcoming Modern Library edition of Ralph Ellison's second novel, 3 Days Before the Shooting, and the author of Ralph Ellison in Progress, a critical study of Ellison's fiction to be published this fall by Yale University Press. He's also the author of the just-published Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip-Hop, which we have for sale tonight, and he's the co-editor of, as I said, the forthcoming Yale Anthology of Rap. So without further ado, please welcome Adam Bradley and Colson Whitehead to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Howdy. Thanks for coming.
Well, Louise just gave the official bio of this man, but I have another story to tell. And it begins in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a place that both he and I know pretty well. I first came across the name Colson Whitehead probably the same time many of you did, back in 1999 with the publication of his luminous debut novel, The Intuitionist. I happened to be in Cambridge at the time as a graduate student studying with Henry Louis Gates Jr., studying African-American literature. And Professor Gates said to me, "I have a book for you." And the book he had was The Intuitionist. Now, he gave it to me for a particular reason, and that reason had to do with an author by the name of Ralph Ellison, whom Louise also mentioned. And Ellison had been an author very close to my heart. I'd been studying his work since I was 19 years old. I'd been named a research assistant to Ellison's literary executor, and was, you know, felt a certain protection toward Ellison, who had passed away in 1994. So anytime somebody said that the new Ellison is on the scene, I approached it with a degree of trepidation. But then I started reading the book, and what I read was something that really reached a level that came so much in the spirit of Ellison, the profundity of the allegory, the texture of the prose. It was the spirit of Ralph Ellison reborn in a new artist, distinct voice, but very much in the spirit of that famed author. Now, we can trace certain literary connections to Ralph Ellison, but one of the things that I'm glad that Colson, you did not get from Ralph Ellison was his particular penchant for not publishing second novels. He spent 40 years working on a second novel, whereas in the last 10 years, you've blessed us with four novels and one sterling collection of essays. And so I guess I want to start here with this connection to Ralph Ellison, this one that's both bone deep in the sense of your commitment to exploring the question of America in the broadest sense, and the insight that Ellison had that whatever else, a true American is also somehow black. And I'm wondering if you could speak about your relationship to that Ellisonian legacy as you see it, not as critics impose it upon you.
Well, I mean, the thing about, thanks. I think the first thing is that when it comes to not following Ellison's footsteps, it's to have like a fireproof house. Because I know his second novel was supposedly burnt up in a fire. So I, you know, when I started writing, I definitely got my fireproof thing together. just to make sure that wouldn't happen to me. I totally dig Ralph Ellison. I hadn't read The Invisible Man in a bunch of years, and I taught it this fall at Princeton while I was visiting there. And I remembered in seventh grade, I had this hippie teacher, Mr. Johnson, and we had this book of short stories was our main book for English class. And they had the Battle Royale chapter of Invisible Man. And I remember we were reading stuff like The Lottery and these sort of oddball things that Mr. Johnson would throw at us. And he was a really cool guy. He would always start talking about taking acid and watching 2001 in the middle of class. And he would direct us to these very interesting parts of the canon. And so I remember reading as a seventh grader the Battle Royale chapter, and it's very, it's absurd, it's cartoony, and not knowing what to make of the various symbolism. Invisible Man is wrestling with other young black men over a commendation, and they're wrestling on an electrified mat, leaping after gold coins, and while the white elders of the town are watching on, smoking cigars and throwing drinks at them. And I thought, this is really strange, and it also really realistic, or sort of somehow speaks in some way that I'm sort of perceiving the world. Ellison and Shirley Jackson and other folks I read in elementary school and high school become part of your toolkit, and you take what you can from each writer, and sometimes it's present very much in a certain book, sometimes it's not so present in a different book. And I think definitely in The Intuitionist, I was thinking very much of Ellison and Pynchon and trying to do a sort of strange story about America that was like lean, but also had a very sort of strong allegorical component.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that really distinguishes Sag Harbor from your previous works of fiction is the introduction of the first-person voice, and you announced this rather amusingly on the cover of the review copy of it being the autobiographical fourth novel instead of the autobiographical first novel so common among writers. What really drew you to the voice that you found with this Sag Harbor, you know, the more personal voice in one sense, but also, you know, the pitfalls of that assumption of using your autobiography as a source for fiction?
Well, I mean, I think my first job out of school was working for the Village Voice, and it was my job to open all the books that we got in every day from publishers, 40 a day, and they would get put into piles, and we reviewed like 40 books a month, and so it was very capricious, and I got a sense of how strange the marketplace was, and also just of the cliches, and so the autobiographical first novel was a cliche, and being a very self-conscious hipster, I couldn't do that. And then it was the mid-90s, so there was a rise like the Slacker Gen X novel. It opens up on the day after Kurt Cobain dies, and you have to like assimilate that into your consciousness, and then, you know, where am I going to get my flannel shirt today? So I didn't want to do the Gen X novel, and there are also sort of cliches about African-American fiction. the Southern novel of black misery, you know, like, I've been to hell and, you know, drank all the gravy out of the skillet, and now you're gone, or whatever. And I didn't want to do that.
Got all the pots. Yeah.
So, but I did want to talk about race and technology and the city, but I had to do it in a weird sort of way, and so elevator inspectors. I'm a little older now, and I've avoided using sort of more personal material, so it seemed time to do it. If, you know, there's something you're afraid of tackling in your work, you have to do it sooner or later. So I felt I was ready. You know, 20 years had passed, and I didn't really like adolescence, but I figured I had enough perspective and distance to maybe shape it into something that could work as a story. And then in terms of the first-person narrator, I had tried, you know, many times to write a book with a first-person narrator. And after like 20 pages, it always lapsed into some sort of New York hipster speak that was very close to the way I used to think. And so I didn't actually have the technical chops to do a first-person narrator for a full book until a couple years ago. So it's, you know, in coming around to this material, I had to like take some time to digest adolescence, then also become a better writer, you know, good enough of a writer to put it in the way that it comes out in Sag Harbor.
I mean, one of the things that has been like a through line in a lot of the reviews has been this rather bold statement of people saying, you know what, this is a novel that doesn't have a lot of tension, doesn't have a lot of incident in it. And yet I think that may be, at least to this reader's mind, a misreading of in fact, the fact that there is a great deal of incident. In any time you describe the life of a 15-year-old, there is incident involved. So I'm wondering, I can't even remember my 15th year. I think it's post-traumatic stress disorder sort of situation.
No, totally.
But I mean, so why that moment, which is at once so already freighted with all of this adolescent significance, that this is the, you know, the summer of 69 or whatever, you know, the coming of age story where, you know, all of these major things happen. How did you avoid falling into those really obvious pitfalls, and what do you think you ended up with on the other end of it?
There are a couple things about that. I didn't like Catcher in the Rye as a kid. I'm sure if I read it now, I'd like it. But at the time, I felt like, who's this guy walking around saying, like, oh, everyone's a phony. Like, if I went around saying that, my parents would be like, and? Like, that's what we told you when you were two, you know? It's not like a news flash. And so I couldn't relate to a certain kind of Caulfield-esque misery. And then, is this a coming-of-age novel? Like, I don't know. Like, I didn't want to do the thing where, like, they find a dead body in the woods and then, like, Stand By Me starts playing. I didn't want to do the thing where the two kids are standing on the tree, and then one kid shakes the branch, and the other kid falls and dies, and the other one has to come to like a separate piece about it, whatever that one is called. I want to not, you know, add this, in, you know, these invented melodramatic moments, because I think my childhood was pretty boring, and there weren't these, you know, huge moments where I was transformed and I suddenly became the person I am today. I sort of plod along and like incrementally create a self. I think that's like what most people do. So the main character, Benji, has this idea that he'll be transformed by the end of the summer. He's a dork who wants to become more than a dork. And but things don't really happen that way. So in between Memorial Day and Labor Day, you know, at least in my case, I was only, you know, 0.001% smarter than I was at the beginning, despite all my dreams of reinvention, you know, I'd become a cool guy or whatever. So the problem was like how to narrate these really small moments and make them into something interesting. Your first crappy minimum wage job, going to the, you know, dealing with the kid who has the car, who's become sort of a dick because he has the car. These things that, you know, we sort of go through and are sort of really quotidian. How do you make them interesting? So that was sort of the challenge I put to myself. And, you know, it did provide, you know, some trouble because there aren't these sort of huge moments where they go swimming, there's a shark and stuff like that.
What ends up carrying it to me is the voice, is Benji's voice, is the kind of, I think at one point you talk about the grammatical acrobatics that Benji and his friends engage in, the way that they have a spirit of play with language that, you know, we've always seen, particularly in the African American tradition, through the dozens and signifying and so forth like that. But it seems like you're having a hell of a lot of fun with these characters and with the kinds of just witty games with language and,
sure,
and
sure.
Even with profanity too. There's a certain profundity to the profanity in this book. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that and maybe even read some from the book.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I came from a big TV-watching household. And early on, I was like 8 or 9 and watching HBO specials of George Carlin and Richard Pryor. And definitely their worldview informed mine. And I think as a former critic, I like to sort of zoom in on things and get really in there and sort of riff for a couple pages and hopefully... I'm becoming a better editor to know when I'm gone too far. But so I had fun with trying to figure out how to sort of analyze their profanity. So here we go. That's on. So in this chapter, they're going to be picked up by an older kid, Randy, who has like a car and can take him around. So he's kind of creepy, but he's older and can buy beer, so they hang out with him. And the parents of these kids work in the city and only come out on weekends, and so they have the days to themselves. And so Benji's a narrator. He has two friends that he's hanging out with, Bobby, and the other one is NP. NP is a nickname. It stands for Nigga Please. Because he's so ridiculous that whatever comes out of his mouth, nigga please, is the only appropriate response. And then, I used to read this a lot when I was working on it, and in Seattle, someone asked me what garanimals were. Garanimals are mix and match separates for kids. If you have trouble thinking up how to dress your, you know, think of how to dress your kid, you can use garanimals. So that's the only real allusion in this section. And there's a visual aid. You want, and NP has just asked for a Coke out of Benji's fridge. You want sprinkles with that Coke? Bobby asked. NP had a job at Johnny Waffle, the new ice cream joint in town. And whenever we went to visit him for freebies, we taunted him over the stupid shit he had to say all day. Whip on top, waffle cone, slob your knob. NP had also been ribbing Bobby about his Scarsdale mansion lately, causing Bobby to push back a little with this insult. Shut up, you pleather members only wearing motherfucker, MP said, which might appear to be a non sequitur as Bobby was wearing a t-shirt and shorts. But there was history there, context. It was a reference to some intel from our friend who'd informed us that he'd run into Bobby during the school year and described how Bobby was wearing a windbreaker that looked suspiciously like a knockoff members only jacket. No small misdemeanor, that. The trend that summer, insult-wise, was toward grammatical acrobatics, the unlikely collage. One smashed a colorful and evocative noun or a proper noun into a pejorative, gluing them together with an in-verb. I'm not sure of the syntactical parentage of the in-verbs, so I'll just call them the in-verbs. Verbal noun, gerund-like creature, cog in the adjectival machine. As was the case with some of the people in my living room, there was a little uncertainty in the bloodlines. Looking was a common inverb. So as you can see, there's the modifier, the inverb, and the object. Some sample modifiers are Angela Davis, if they had like a big afro or something. Gorbachev, if they had like a big birthmark on their head. George Jefferson, I think that's very self-explanatory. The inverb here is looking, and the object's motherfucker, bitch, nigger. So if you're going to make an insult out of this array, you'd go, you Angela Davis-looking motherfucker, you Gorbachev-looking bitch, you George Jefferson-looking nigger, and so on. And wearing also made the rounds. So in this case, again, you have the modifier, inverb, and object. The modifier is this time messed up garanimal ass, 99-cent gold chain, fake Adidas, the inverb is wearing, and the objects again, motherfucker, bitch, nigger. So in this case, you'd go, and you can mix and match, but you'd go, you messed up garanimal ass wearing motherfucker, you 99-cent gold chain wearing bitch, you fake Adidas wearing nigger, and so on. And you could also preface things with a throat-clearing you fucking, as in, you fucking Chaka from Land of Lost wearing motherfucker, looking motherfucker, directed at Bobby, for example, who had light brown skin, light brown hair, and indeed shared these characteristics with the hominid sidekick on the Saturday morning adventure show, The Land of the Lost. You fucking acted as a rhetorical pause, allowing the speaker a few extra seconds to pluck some splendid modifier out of the invective ether, and giving the listener a chance to gird himself for the top-notch put-down slash splendid imagery to follow. But true masters of the style sometimes attached the nonsensical with your monkey ass as a kicker to convey sincerity and depth of feeling. Hence, you fucking Kunta Kinte-looking motherfucker with your monkey ass. You may have noticed that the in-verbs were generally visual. The heart of the critique concerned what you were putting out into the world, the vibes you gave off, which is what made them so devastating when executed well. This ordinance detonated in the area between you and the mirror, between you and what you thought everyone else was seeing.
How am I going to follow that with a question? With your monkey ass. I do have this, though, because there's an amazing depth of humor here, but it's a humor that maybe in the words of Charles Baudelaire, you know, the wise man never laughs but that he trembles. There's a depth of maybe a night side to the book as well that doesn't come out as often as one would imagine, but it comes out in very powerful moments. And so I wanted to think about Sag Harbor in terms of almost in terms of a tragicomic work, in the sense that again, to invoke Ellison, in his understanding of the tragicomic, and in particular of the blues, as he says, an autobiographical chronicle of personal catastrophe expressed lyrically. And before we get too profound with it, I mean, the particular catastrophes in Benji's life may seem rather prosaic. You know, maybe it's the travails of a young man trying to figure out how to impress a girl, or maybe it's the scene that we may want to talk about a little bit with the BB gun war that goes on. But there are a couple moments that do come through, and particularly in the family relationships. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you find a balance between this kind of rollicking humor that you achieve at different points of the novel, but then also gesturing toward a depth of human feeling, a range of emotions that stretches all the way into the most profound and even frightening, as in the case of Benji's father, who has a violent streak, has problems with alcohol and so forth. Could you speak just about that kind of balance?
Yeah, I mean, going back to Richard Pryor or like Beckett, I think you can go. These guys are, I find them, totally hilarious. And then Richard Pryor will be on some kind of crazy routine, and then we'll talk about burning himself up freebasing. And suddenly he's like hit you in the face and brought the humor to a different place. And you're laughing at him burning himself up, and he's running down the street on fire. And you're laughing because he's laughing, but that's crazy. It's sort of insane. And then I think in Beckett I see the same sort of thing where I find like people being buried up to their necks in sand where they can't move to be like a high form of realism. Like I relate to that in my day-to-day experience. And so folks who can veer between the comic and the tragic, have always had a real appeal for me. In terms of structuring the novel, it was great to have a character whose narrative voice could accommodate different, kinds of humor. My first book, The Intuitionist, is a fake detective novel, and it's very deadpan, and I'm trying to do like a fake hard-boiled, you know, detective novel imitation, and the sentences are very clipped, and Lala Mae Watson is very a very repressed character. So the humor in there is very deadpan. And so this book, you know, it was just a lot of fun to sort of let it rip. But there is also this other sort of, you know, darkness to our day-to-day that I see anyway, so that's going to come in. In terms of how the parents function and how it functions in the book, I have to create forward movement because there isn't a very strong plot. And so I think by juxtaposing these sort of humorous moments with the more grim moments, you get this forward movement because you're being sort of knocked around and buffeted and you're not sure what's coming next. And so the barbecue from hell chapter five, is followed by the sort of mini caper where the kids are trying to get into a club to see UTFO, and the stakes are different than they were in the stakes with the, you know, the parent chapter. And I like the effect that you get by having this really sort of grim chapter and then this sort of the cognitive dissonance of the next chapter, because it's not what happened before isn't really remarked upon, and the text is sort of imitating the main character's denial of what's going on in his life and his family's situation. And so, you know, I'm trying to narrate the darkness so that it works technically, it works for his story, and it works in a way that is going to pull the reader through.
Now, another heady topic that you've come to terms with in across your fiction, of course, is one of racial politics. And explicitly with Apex Hides the Hurt, you really grapple with race in a overt manner. This is a book, though, where the elements of racial difference play out in ways that are that are perhaps less explicit, if only because we're dealing largely with an all-black world. I mean, which almost reminds you in some ways of Charlie Brown's Peanuts, where, you know, the adults are kind of just wah-wah-wah, and you know, the other, and there's really a focus on these young kids, these young black kids, and their sphere of influence. And yet, a number of the reviews have thought of this book in terms of its post-raciality, maybe even a post-black aesthetic. Uh-huh. And so I want to spend a moment with this, sure, because sure. This is we're living, at least if we understand the pundits, in a post-racial America. I guess we don't see color anymore now that we got a black president. So I'm wondering how you feel about that particular reading of this novel. I have my own opinions on it, but we got to hear
sure,
you.
Sure, sure. So the book is being reviewed, and it was on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, and I was very happy. And there's my face up there. I was kooky. And the review by, you know, very talented writer Torre called it a post-black novel. And the way he defined post-blackness was the ability to, without anxiety, draw from a lot of different kinds of sources. So so-called black writers, so-called white writers, I suppose anything you want to, you know, you're making your sort of jerry-rigged self, and that's okay. But I think if you're ever any kind of individual, that was always okay. I mean, you take what you love and you take what works for you and you create a self. And if you're a writer, you definitely draw from, you know, Raymond Carver, you draw from Toni Morrison, Octavia Butler, you draw from Borges, and you create some sort of voice for yourself out of this different array of influences. So that's like the natural progression of becoming an artist or a writer. So, you know, in a certain sense, we're all post-black now. If we have our, you know, some sort of concrete identity, and if you have some sort of real artistic voice, you've already come through these this neurosis of what is okay to use and what's not okay to use. In terms of the kumbaya moment we're all living through, you know, there are many places I could go where I would just find out, you know, how post-black I really am. You know, it's like, was I speeding, sheriff? And then, you know, the sheriff's like, boy, don't let the sun set on you. And I'd be like, don't you read the New York Times? Like, I'm totally post-black. I don't even know what you're talking about. So...
I mean, you can't get 15 pages into this book without seeing a quotation from W.E.B. Du Bois. And that you draw from the Souls of Black Folk and his whole famous passage of double consciousness. And, you know, this idea that one is both the integral self, but also the self as reflected from the outside world. And for Du Bois, that outside world was one that was white and that was estimating him as a black man as something less than in the great chain of being. So I'm wondering about double consciousness because it's such a supple and useful metaphor for identity across all identities, racial, gender, and otherwise. And so I guess what drew you to actually quote that in the book?
I just want to get it out of the way. And, you know, like you always, I think I'm trying to use history and pop culture in a way that is true to the time, but also true to, allows me to talk about larger themes. And so Du Bois supposedly did come out to Sag Harbor in the, you know, I'm not sure, the 20s or 30s, and went to a fish fry. And so that's part of the history of the community and allows me a way to talk, to bring in this, you know, quote about double consciousness. And perhaps I'm being, taking too much liberty with the metaphor of it, but it does cut across, many different kinds of experience. The immigrant experience, 100 years ago, Irish Americans, Jewish Americans coming here, you have this self in a culture that is constantly chafing against a larger American culture, and how do you accept, reject, just get through the day? And I think it's also, to even abuse the metaphor more, I think it works for the teenage years. How does your individual self cope with these, horrible signs of the outside world, this larger community that you're a part of and trying to enter, that you can't escape? How do you create a concrete self that can withstand being gazed upon with bemused contempt and pity, as Du Bois puts it, I think.
Close.
So I think the teenage self is a self that struggles with double consciousness. And so by putting it early on, I think I set up some of the terms of what this book's going to be about.
Yeah, and I mean, there's another passage I want to draw you to, just read one sentence. According to the world, we were the definition of paradox, black boys with beach houses. Now, that's a different kind of Du Boisian double consciousness, perhaps, the duality of identity. But one of the striking things that you do is, to my reading at least, is not to let it stop there, not to let it stop with this idea of the paradox as defined from that which is outside, but in fact, turning it on its head and having the perspective come from within this paradox, which is not a paradox at all for those who were living it, and picks up again with Du Bois, where he talks about this double consciousness is not necessarily just a burden, but also a gift. He says, gifted with second sight. So I'm wondering if you could play out that a little bit and think about Benji and what perspective he offers, maybe as a distinct voice in the literary canon now. And what is it that you would say are his greatest contributions to helping to make sense of this America, this world?
Yeah, I can't say what his contribution is. I can say I had fun with the character and his different ways that identity could play out in very absurd sort of ways. And so he's a dork who goes to... I read last night in Berkeley, and I was told that dork is the new nerd, and I should embrace dork instead of nerdiness. So I'm trying that out. For me, nerd, dork, geek, it's all the same. But he's not up on the teenage codes of his white high school, and by being so backward, he's not up on the teenage codes of his black peers in Sag Harbor. And so the first couple weeks of the summer always become a bit of a black boot camp where he catches up on all the stuff he was too foolish and dumb to, that he sort of missed out on. So these debates about how we pick and choose, what's a paradox and what's not, play out, I think, in sort of fun ways in the book. And I try to find things that would allow me to have these sort of larger sort of discussions. And so there's a bit around that section that you just quoted where the kids are arguing, did African Mambata steal from Kraftwerk, or did Kraftwerk steal from African Mambata? Who, you know, is the song Planet Rock embodying black theft from a white artist, or vice versa? And does it really matter? Is it just like, you know, again, building that jerry-rigged self from whatever is available? So, you know, Benji, he likes new wave, and he also likes hip-hop. But you're not supposed to say you like new wave because you're too Y-identified. And so how do you make this sort of self that is you know, post-black, and I think Tori's definition, that, you know, can accommodate the wide range of experiences that we come across, and these little moments where we sort of pick and choose ourselves?
Well, let's explore that a little bit with hip-hop in particular, because the thing that Benji is living in and absorbing in his popular culture includes everything from the Smiths to UTFO and beyond. But there was one striking passage where you say this about rap music. You say rap was a natural resource. Might as well pay for sunlight or the very breeze or an early morning car alarm going off. You know, the idea of for Benji at least, of hip-hop being something that's maybe not of the soil, but of the street, of his surroundings, and kind of the cultural air that he breathes. So what about the role of hip-hop as a site for this kind of cultural interpenetration? I mean, you talked about it with Kraftwerk and African Bambaataa, but more about how this works as a novel of the hip-hop era.
Sure. I mean, I picked 85. You know, I was going to write about teenagers. I know about being a teen in the 80s, so what year would I choose? And I chose 85 because I wanted to write about the Slick Rick, Dougie Fresh single, The Show, Lottie Dottie. For me, that was like an important cultural moment. Because who is this insane troubadour, Slick Rick, and his love of Oil of Olay? You know, he takes like 2 minutes to dress, you know, to talk about getting dressed. And when that, you know, the song started appearing on bootleg tapes, you know, in the middle of summer, and everybody was just like, what is this new sort of song? It's insane. Unfortunately, it didn't serve the book, so I was stuck in 85, and I ended up using UTFO's Roxanne, Roxanne, and The Message, which came out a few years earlier, but to talk about, you know, the kids' stories. You know, 1985-ness serves to, you know, serves the boys, because up to that time, hip-hop has a really sort of random, oddball identity. UTFO, they're these guys with different characters. They dress like the village people, and they're pretty silly. If you see like the album covers or the old videos on YouTube, it's like, did we really think this was cool? You know, it's insane. But in the same way that, you know, hip-hop is innocent in a certain kind of way, and Run DMC is rapping about staying in school in this weird moment in 85, on the horizon, the boys are becoming men, and hip-hop is going to become more mature. On the horizon is 89 and the various cultural influences that create a more commercialized hip-hop and a gangsterized hip-hop, you know, one sort of strain that becomes popular. And so these boys who worry about being authentic, you know, are they sellouts because they have this beach community? Are they down with the street, whatever their idea of the street is? So they're wrestling with their identity, and they act out with BB guns and pretend to be gangsters in the same way that Ice Cube is pretending to be a gangster in the late 80s, and that's a kind of mask. And so there's this anxiety about what authentic blackness is that can, you know, be sort of discussed through the evolution of hip-hop. You know, I find it interesting, you know, Ice Cube was born in 69, and he grew up on Run DMC and UTFO, and he's producing this persona of the gangster a couple years later. And now he's doing these Disney movies about child daycare and like road trips with screaming kids. And so he's an actor, you know, and I think that, and we're all sort of actors in our own sort of way as we sort of try on selves and move through the world. And so because I like pop culture, I'm always trying to find ways of using it in fiction, usefully.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Colson, would you mind reading again for us? Give us a little.
Sure. There's a variety of mishaps in the book. As you know, you pointed out, the reviews say that not a lot happens. It's not, the book's not very interesting or worthwhile, worth spending your time on. And this is an example of the pulse-pounding action in the book where he gets a haircut. And it's the first time his dad has always cut his hair. And now his friend Clive has done it. It was the first time someone else had cut my hair. Since I could remember, me and Reggie had a ritual. When our hair got too crazy, we asked our father to give us a haircut, and he put us off, saying that he was too busy or had a long day at his office. And over the next few weeks or months, we'd ask again, spacing out our requests so as not to nag like an old woman. And then eventually he'd come home tipsy after a meeting and break out the scissors. Black barbers the world over, they use electric clippers. These are modern times. In many sectors, technological advances are welcomed and embraced. My father, however, loved his special pair of old school barber scissors, and we loved them too because the sound of the long thin blades sniping against each other was the sound of his undivided attention. As I sat on a chair, holding a towel tight around my bony shoulders and staring into the black and white subway tile, he trimmed and trimmed, grumbling about the light, tilting my head to and fro with a firm push of his index and middle fingers. He drew up tufts with a pick and squinted and clipped. I murmured the prime directive to myself, don't move your head, do not move your head, even though it never worked. I moved. He always moved. He always told me I moved, no matter how much I concentrated, no matter how many oaths and pledges I devised between haircuts, as if a new arrangement of words might make things turn out differently next time. At some point, he'd say, you moved your head, now I gotta even it out. And I cursed myself as he cut and cut, and my fro grew shorter and shorter and shorter. But when he was done, it was perfect, like when he grilled. You had to admit that despite everything, he was a master griller. It was one of those things he did well. You couldn't say anything against it. It was a cornerstone of our reality. He gave us miniature versions of his own cut, the same one he'd given himself since high school, when he took over haircut duties from his father. The haircuts remained perfect for whole hours. Don't be thrown off by the fact that no camera ever recorded them. The spell broke when you took a shower or slept on them, whereupon all his tucks and pats and proddings were undone and our superb crowns became utterly misshaped and disordered, the underlying principles revealed as counterfeit. What occurred on my scalp could not be called a style in any true sense of the word, and it got wilder the longer it got. It was a weird black amoeba testing the edges of itself, throwing out nappy pseudopods here and suddenly there, an unpredictable new direction every day. I swear it lived. And I've come to believe that its ever-shifting lumps and tendrils were a doomed attempt at communication with the humans. The tragedy of the day after haircuts, and all the days after. The months passed until we had to admit to ourselves that the world hated us, and the process started anew. Needless to say, I had no idea how fucked up the haircuts were at the time. To us, they were normal, just how things were done in our house. Raise your hand if you can relate. My delusions ended that spring when I was cleaning out my desk during one of my periodic purges of nerdery. My 20-sided die possessed a curious will, returning to pester and trouble me, even though I'd thrown it out 100 times, the specter of Dungeons and Dragons games past. This time, I threw it out the window, and I found it under the radiator a week later. That's like the magic realism part of the book. I stashed dog-eared copies of Famous Monsters in a box at the back of the closet and hid all the comic books I'd bought since the last purge in case a girl materialized in my room due to a transporter malfunction. I was in a good mood or something, like feeling optimistic, like someone had chuckled at a joke I'd made in history or biology, and it had gone to my head. I came across a packet of fifth-grade class pictures under my copy of Swamp Thing, number 35. It is the nettlesome quality of elementary school pictures to reveal the true natures of our childhoods. Nothing is how we remember it, and all the necessary alterations we've made in order to survive with semi-functioning psyches are exposed. Best to leave them alone. Looking back, I think I had what is best described as a prelapsarian fondness for fifth grade, its lack of complication, no more. Miss Fredericks, the social studies teacher whose cruel smile had haunted me for years, and who was actually the default setting in my nightmares whenever I needed an evil authority figure, had a melancholy face now that I really examined it. She seemed a bit too skinny, almost ill. And I got to thinking about what her house looked like, picturing the shadows in the kitchenette where she prepared her lonely meals. Two scoops of cottage cheese on a big leaf of wilted iceberg lettuce and a side of misery. She never appeared in my dreams again. Scanning the rest of the photograph, it was clear that none of us, teacher and pupils alike, had remained untouched by that horrible epidemic making the rounds back then. 70s fashion, the manic stripes and prints of the skirts and shirts and pants, a kind of rash on our flesh that only a new decade could cure. Then there were the kids themselves. No one looked like they were supposed to. These changeling creatures surrounded me in polyester, touching my elbows, strangers. I traced a finger along their faces like a movie amnesiac. That must be my best friend. His name is Andy. And that's the smart girl who sat in front of me all year. She ate frankfurters out of a bionic woman thermos filled with hot, oily water. Then there was my own face. My face was not the one I remembered showing to the world. Were my eyes so dark those days? There was something amiss with my mouth, always my mouth, even before I got braces. My lips were chapped, sure, but the chappiness seemed to have extended its territory so that a huge white halo encircled my mouth like I'd been eating ashes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then there was that thing on top, that really fucked up haircut. I recovered from the class picture pretty quickly. It wasn't that bad. Seeing the white letters identifying my homeroom, the construction paper map of France we'd toiled over that winter, I felt a nice warm tingle of nostalgia. The killer was the four panes of wallet-sized photos beneath the class picture. It was just me there. They should have stopped me. They should have stopped me at any number of checkpoints. As I tried to leave the apartment, here a close relative would have been key. The doorman could have taken me aside. We got along, him and me, or so I thought, trading haze with enthusiasm. But he said nothing. Certainly the bus driver, de facto deputy of the body politic, could have forbid me entry, ripping my bus pass in half and tossing it to the dirty black treads. The security guard outside school should have beat me with his flashlight. And surely my homeroom teacher, Miss Barrett, should have shoved her big wooden desk up against the classroom door. Back brace or no back brace. All of them should have said, "What the fuck is up with your hair?" Obviously, it had been months since my last trim. Instead of a haircut, the photographer had captured some primordial process unfolding. The universe tugged and pressed on my hair with invisible fingers, the same way it had pulled up mountains to the sky and gouged the deepest ocean chasms, where the only living beings are pale, boneless things rooting around in everlasting gloom. What else is there to say but that in my vicinity, larger forces were at work, the ancient underpinnings of it all. There are natural laws. The third law of thermodynamics says that as temperature approaches absolute zero, the entropy of a system approaches a constant. Sir Isaac Newton's third law of motion holds that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The entity on my head was proof of another fundamental law. A fucked up afro tends toward complete fucked upness at an exponential rate over time, as expressed by the equation AN equals F times T. AN equals F times T, where AN is absolute nappiness, F is fucked upness, and T is time. The pane of photos was uncut, of course. Who'd want a picture of that in their wallet? Poisoning their money.
All right, I promise we're going to go to questions, but we gotta end, though, with one thing. I got to do lightning round with you real quick. So,
okay,
so
sure.
James Lipton style. So
sure.
So what's your favorite word? I actually have to look. We have to look James Lipton.
Okay. My favorite word?
Yeah. What's your favorite word?
Me.
Least favorite word?
You.
Your favorite character in fiction other than Benji?
Oh, that's a good question. Vladimir or Estragon.
Who's your favorite old school rap group? This is a personal question.
Houdini. I mean, the crazy hat that dude was wearing, this leather hat, it was totally awesome.
And then finally, because there's so much, we didn't even get into the ice cream in this book, and I know you hate it, but still, what was your favorite ice cream flavor?
They had this flavor that was like white pistachio. It was awesome. But yeah, I worked in an ice cream store for like 3 summers, and you know, like Norman Mailer had like World War II to animate Naked and the Dead. I had like 3 summers in an ice cream store to animate certain chapters in this book. And so I would eat ice cream all day, every day, and would get sick every day from eating ice cream. So I hate ice cream, but pistachio when I ate ice cream was my favorite.
Beautiful. Let's go to some questions. Let's open it up.
One of the things I found interesting was that you were saying that in this world of kids, the adults were not relevant. And there seemed to be an understanding among all the kids that whatever problems the adults had, they just would not speak of it.
Well, two different things. I mean, part of the setup of the book is that the parents are in the city during the week and the kids are left to their own devices on weekends. And so that's actually true. That's, you know, that was my experience. I would never let my, you know, 4-year-old, when she's, you know, a teenager, sort of stay by herself. But it seemed to make sense in the 80s. I'm not sure why. There's latchkey-itis all over the place. The separate thing about parents is just Benji's psychology of what he knows about the world and what he's accepting into himself about the way his family works and the world works. And so he's in a bit of cognitive dissonance about the various dysfunction in his family. And so the parents are off to the side because he's not thinking about them, because he can't think about them.
Do you still get out to Sag Harbor much?
Yeah, well, it's a thing that happens where you hit college and you get all militant, and it's like, I'm not going to hang out with these bougie Negroes in Sag Harbor, you know. I'm not one of these dudes. But frankly, you know, it is just nice to go out there. And so my mom moved out there full-time 20 years ago, so that I would visit her. And then my wife and I rent my aunt's place, and we go out there for 3 weeks. I do a lot of grilling. And it was from going out there, well, I do a lot of grilling. That's what... Everybody needs a hobby. One of the things that sort of gave me the idea for the book was walking around when I had friends out and having to explain who all these weird people were that we kept running into. Like, you know, that's Joe, and one summer I beat him up, and then he beat me up next summer, and they started dating my sister, and my sister beat him up. And so every person we came across had this huge backstory. Every house we passed, you know, like, that's where so-and-so used to live, but they don't come out anymore because his dad had like another family in Florida, and that was like a big scandal. There's like a big family. There's other family itis that also went around in Sag Harbor in the 80s. I'm not sure what that was about. But so there's a lot of material there to use, and so I decided to use it. So.
Right back. Be right behind you.
I found in some of your previous novels that at the end of the book, there's always some sort of something left unsaid, like at Apex Hides the Hurt, you never find out the name of the town that he decided. And I wonder if, I mean, obviously I'm sure that's what you do on purpose, but do you ever get people asking what the name was or why there's, you sort of leave it open-ended?
Well, some of the books are open-ended, some are less so. The name of the town actually is in Apex, a few pages from the end. It starts with a ST and ends with an E. So maybe you can pick it up. It's, yeah, maybe it's a little too subtle. Unfortunately, I saw it, so I apologize for that. So, sometimes, you know, the strategic open ending is useful. Sometimes it's not. I mean, in this book, you know, it ends with the end of the summer and the new school year is looming, and I think that's a good place to end. I think we know a bit about what's going to happen to Benji because it's been narrated by his adult self. So we know that he gets some shit together later on. It may take 10 years or 20 years, but he does, you know, build a semi-functioning psyche.
Who's your favorite musician and who's your favorite rapper?
Favorite musician? The two dudes from Daft Punk. You know, it was one of my biggest tragedies of my life. Like, I listen to a lot of loud music when I'm working. And I remember writing chapter 5 and typing away. And then, like, I went on the web and it's like Daft Punk was playing live in Brooklyn at Coney Island. And I was like, oh, I'm having such a fun time working. I'm not going to go and see Daft Punk. And then their live record came out a few months later. And as I was writing the last chapter, and I was like, why did I not go to see Daft Punk on this tour? So my favorite musicians are these two Daft Punk guys. They wear robot helmets. I've never seen them. I don't know what they look like. But they've been a constant for the last 10 years in my books, since John Henry days. They have a really annoying song. Am I going too long? They have a really annoying song called Rock and Roll, which was introduced to me by my friend Gary, who's up there. It's 10 minutes long and incredibly annoying. And so the best thing to do is, like, go, if it's on a jukebox in a bar, you put it on, and people are like running out screaming. And so I was listening to that a lot when I was writing John Henry days. Favorite rapper? I don't listen to a lot of hip-hop anymore. As I was going back to the old guys when I was researching the book. So maybe...
Houdini?
Houdini? Well, you know, they were rappers, they were crooners, they had R&B songs. But I'll go with Slick Rick because he was, you know, out of nowhere and such a strange guy.
More questions?
What are you reading?
I'm trying to figure out what to do next. I'm really sort of at a loss. And so I brought some nonfiction to see if that would jar or something loose. And I brought Michael Lewis's Moneyball and Liar's Poker. So I started Liar's Poker, but it's like, it seems to be this sort of glorification of like bad bankers in the 80s. And after this year, I don't want to hear about bad bankers, you know, how dynamic they are. You know, they're assholes. So I've been reading Moneyball about the Oakland A's and how they sort of figured out how to drop the myths of baseball. So that's been a fun thing to read on this trip.
I think right here in the third row, you still have a question?
I'll be loud. I'm curious because we're sort of contemporaries, this whole sort of coming of age in the 80s and sort of seeing where that evolves. What's next? What do you see yourself writing in the sort of next epic in your career?
I have no idea what's next. I mean, usually when I have a book come out, I'm sort of knee deep in something. But this book was so different that it sort of changed. You know, I have no idea what the next thing to do is. In terms of holding the standard of the 80s, and I feel like people in their 30s and 40s are now replacing the boomers who had like ascendancy for so long. And so I always hate it when August comes around and it's like, we're going to celebrate the summer of love. You know, it's the 30th anniversary of the summer of love. It's the 31st anniversary of the summer of love. Like, when can we stop celebrating the anniversary of the summer of love? It's like, you know, there's always like the documentary where, you know, they show like the hippie with the spangled vest. And it's like, you know, it was a time of hope, a time of pain. And it's like, one pill makes you big, taller. And they're always playing that Jefferson Airplane song. And so, but frankly, the boomers had control of the cultural apparatus, so they could do what they want to. And now we're taking over, and so we're going to talk about Star Wars and ram it down the throats of everyone else. Because that's what you do when you're in control. So...
two more.
Wait. Oh, I'm sorry. Was there ever a time in your life when you did stand-up comedy?
No. No, I mean, but, you know, I do, you know, draw from people like George Carlin. I was so upset when he died last year, and Richard Pryor. And so, like, their off-kilter humor, I think, is in my work. And definitely this narrator allows me to, you know, utilize that sort of, that type of humor a lot more.
All right, one more question.
I was just wondering, did you ever use, like, a cake cutter or just a regular natural fork to try to help your hair? Or do you know what a cake cutter is? That might have been, like,
no,
a
I mean, I went from my dad's butchered haircuts to just, like, going hand, getting it all off, and to this, which doesn't, you know, take a lot of maintenance. So, I don't know.
Well, let's thank Colson Whitehead for coming out tonight.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.